The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning. You're listening to Campus Voices on 91.3 WVUD. I'm Allison Delaney with Liz Webb.
And today we are welcoming back our panel on gender issues in the workplace. We have three professors of management from UD's Lerner College of Business and Economics, Wendy Smith, Amanda Ballou, and Kyle Emick, and Professor Jessica Edwards of the English Department.
Last time we were together, we were talking about the male role in the gender issues of the workplace. I know, Professor Ballou, you wanted to add on to that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's this really great quote towards the end of a TED Talk by a guy named Michael Kimmel, where he says, "Privilege is invisible to those who have it." And he's specifically talking about gender equity to males. He's addressing his male counterpart, you know, his male fellow males. And he means that, you know, as a white male, he didn't realize he was privileged. And why would he? Because it's invisible to those who have it. And so one of the things that Wendy Smith, my colleague here, and I have been working on with this Women's Leadership Initiative that the Lerner College of Business and Economics is leading is getting our male students more involved so that they understand this privilege that they don't realize they have. And it made me think, actually, too, that, I'm a woman and I do research in this area, and I'm extremely passionate about women's leadership and gender equity. And so I decided that I wanted to work on this women's leadership initiative. But this goes in both directions. You know, men can feel very lonely in certain areas, too. So just a little story. My husband was a stay-at-home dad the first several years when we started our family. And I remember how lonely it was for him. You know, he would take our kids to the little gym or to activities. And he commented on how the other moms didn't talk to him. The other stay-at-home moms would hang out with each other and they would talk to each other and they were polite. And I don't think they meant to be dismissive of him, but he said it was very lonely. And other moms we knew that were staying at home would say, "Well, why doesn't he join one of the moms clubs? Or he could come out with me and my girlfriends and we get our kids together for a play date." And my husband finally said to me, "I am a stay-at-home dad. That doesn't make me a mom. I'm not a woman. I'm still not a woman. I'm still a man. I just happen to be a man that stays home with my kids." And so it was very lonely for him. And it's funny, in hindsight, I've always kind of thought, you know, if he wanted to do something about that, he could go start a, you know, a men's stay-at-home dad's club or something, you know, or he could work on these kinds of issues like I'm working on women's leadership. And then I realized, wow, I have the same kind of privilege, this unaware privilege as a mom and a woman, where I didn't realize that there would be this loneliness for somebody like my husband in that role.
We were talking about the idea of microaggressions or microbehaviors, which are these like tiny little behaviors in which we treat somebody in ways we assume they should behave because of their identity. So we treat men as if they're supposed to be leaders more than women. But I think what Mandy's saying is that we treat women as if they're supposed to be taking care of the family and dealing with domestic work more than men, and don't give men the opportunity to do that. And so, for example, if we want to create a condition where when it comes to family and work balance, both men and women have the opportunities for both, we don't give men one of the challenges for men is that they don't have the opportunity to do that. And my husband had a similar situation, also a fabulous academic. When we had our children, it was kind of assumed that I would take maternity leave. And despite the fact that paternity leave was offered to him, it was kind of assumed he wouldn't take it. And so I think we have to be thoughtful about the ways in which these kinds of micro behaviors really impact all people, no matter who they are.
And I think language shapes a lot of those perceptions, right? How we understand particular categories, as we talked about last time, and how categories shape how people are perceived. I think identity development is a huge part of that, too. So thinking about, and maybe even helping students to think about who they are in relation to the world, how history shapes all of us, and how we can sort of push back against those narratives that define what it means to be a man, maybe, or define what it means to be a woman, even, and try to, again, create new stories, stories that help to give us new avenues and new ways, fresh ways of understanding what it means to be human. And I think that's sort of where we're getting to, right? So not siloing people, but actually saying we're people, and there's more than one way to be a person. There are more than two ways to be a person. And yeah, what that looks like. So beyond sort of magical thinking, but more intentional sort of practiced ways of knowing and being.
So I think it's interesting also that Amanda was telling the story about her husband, about how he came to her for help in that situation. And it has to do, again, with these expectations that are laid out for specific roles. And the point I want to make is that getting back to women graduating from college, going into the world of work, in many of those roles, it's expected to be male, or that the expectation is that men are meant to fill these roles. So I wanted to get back to a little bit about what men can do to help out their women colleagues. So one of the things that I think was really interesting after I conducted the research, and one of the things about the microbehaviors is I realized I did one before and put Elizabeth McLean, who's the first author on that paper, said her name second, so it could happen to anyone. One of the things that occurred to me is that I really started noticing when women were voicing up in meetings how much they get poo-pooed or put down, or a man, worse, will repeat their idea later. And then if you ask people after the meeting who came up with that idea, they'll say the man came up with that idea instead of the woman who originally brought it up. So one thing I would do is challenge men out there listening to pay more attention in the meetings that you're in when women come up with ideas. And initially, you don't have to step in or say anything. Just watch, observe, and see who gets credit for that idea. And then I would challenge you later on to actually come and be an ally. And maybe you don't have to be aggressive about it, but just say, you know, oh, wait a minute, Wendy, I really liked Wendy's idea before, and we should build off of that after someone else repeats it. So just noticing is one thing.
That story you just told about somebody speaking up, that happened to me, and it happened to me a bunch at a previous place of employment where I would say something, and I very much kind of just got hushed, noticeably. And it happened enough that I stopped speaking up, and I left. I got a different job somewhere else. So it is a real threat to organizations when these things go on without people noticing them, because you can lose. Yeah. In my case, I thought it was pretty good talent, you know, that just got tired of it.
And just one more point on that. This was such a big problem, actually, in the Obama administration, that women within his committees would repeat each other when an idea got ignored. So one woman would come up with an idea, a man within the committee would change the subject, and then the next woman would repeat the exact same idea the previous woman did until it was recognized. So we used to close the talk with this idea that this is definitely happening, as Amanda said, in the real world. Yeah, it's just recognizing it and dealing with it, I guess. Yeah.
And then there are these pieces that, I mean, there are people who probably noticed it too but didn't say anything. So there's a sort of silence around these issues as well. And Audre Lorde talks a little bit about this in her work, Transforming Silence into Language and Action, and why it's important to, when you see something that is not, and you're aware of something that's going on, why it is really important to be able to speak up or offer support or be an advocate for that person to help the entire organization progress. So,
yeah, I would add, as Kyle started us off with saying, that mentoring, sponsorship, support, peer support is huge. And I think that one of the things that happens is that as we go into the workplace and we start to feel this sense that there are these things that are happening, they're a little confusing, I'm not sure what to do about them, and I feel lonely. I feel like I'm the only one experiencing them. And so the opportunity to vet these ideas, to get advice, to figure out what to do is tremendous. And one of the ways best to do that is to have really fabulous mentors to give you advice. The other thing is to have really fabulous sponsors, that is, the people who are going to put you, who are going to advocate on your behalf. So one of the things we know in research particularly is that women are dinged when they negotiate on their behalf more aggressively than men are. One of the solutions to that is we get other people to advocate for us, to speak on our behalf, to make sure that our ideas are being heard or that our needs are being met. So finding great mentors, great sponsors, great advisors is huge. And then finding a great peer group who can reinforce what their experience has been and being able to support provide advice is also tremendous. Mandy had mentioned that we recently started the Lerner Women's Leadership Forum. It's a mid-career executive women looking to move up in their leadership. And part of the value of that forum, besides the skills that they learn and the focus on the kinds of leadership that they want to achieve, is just the community and the networking and the chance to really learn from one another and be supported by one another in the kinds of challenges that they face. So all of those are huge opportunities for being able to be successful in the workplace.
And I'll just add one point to that quickly. It's that a lot of times mentorship is seen as this, you know, giving relationship, but it's actually a two-way street, right? Developing people's abilities, being there to support them is very rewarding. And also you're developing a relationship with someone that's up and coming in your field, which is also beneficial. I guess the point is you don't need to look at mentorship as this thing where I need to go out of my way and give, give, give. It's this thing that's very rewarding to do and is also helping create that broader sense of equality in the workplace.
You had asked earlier about what can we do for men or what can men do. I think that mentorship and sponsorship is part of that, which is that men can, as Kyle said, go out and actively engage women, can actively engage people of color to be their mentors. I think my career has been tremendously advanced because of my mentors, because of my advisor. I don't know if my main advisor ever said, I'm going to start mentoring women specifically, but his mentorship was tremendous and huge. And I think actively thinking about that is something that men can do. At the same time, I think we should be thoughtful about how we mentor men to be effective in their interactions, mentor men in general, but also in their interactions with gender in the workplace. And we could train one another to do a better job of being open to and seeing the ways in which we treat people differently and being more equitable in how we treat them.
We are talking with today Professor Edwards of the English Department and three professors of management from the University of Delaware's Lerner College of Business and Economics, Professor Smith, Professor Ballou, and Professor Emick. There's been a lot of recent media attention on men in the business and entertainment world sexually harassing women. How do you think these cases are affecting workplace dynamics?
So I think this is huge and is going to tremendously impact the dynamics of the workplace. And I think it will for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think it's really important that this moment in history is shining a light on dynamics that have, I mean, essentially sexual harassment in the workplace is a power dynamic. It's a dynamic of a man in power taking and asserting power in a way that makes women very vulnerable and very unempowered and has long-term impacts. I mean, if Mandy is going to walk away from a job because and legitimately because her voice isn't being heard, all the more so when you are in a situation where you are physically threatened and that or your physicality is defining your work success. So I think that it's great that these dynamics are being opened up. One fear I have about them is that because they are so pervasive and because they are so hard to, or can be so hard to address, that rather than really address how we get to a place of effective workplace dynamics between men and women where we can take sexuality out of it, or at least remove that piece from our interactions, that we might lead to a place where men say, like, I don't even want to go there. I'm not going to mentor women because I don't want to be in a place where there might be any either impropriety or assumption of impropriety, or we're not even going to hire women because it's just too messy. And, you know, and so I worry a little bit about the backlash that's going to happen because this watershed of events has been opened. And I think if we were in the best possible scenario is we've opened this watershed, that women who have been assaulted realize that they are not alone and that they can reach out and get support, but that we go to a place where we can actually learn to better navigate those dynamics rather than just walk away from them.
So it's interesting, every time I turn on the radio or the TV in the morning and I hear another major name and someone who I always thought was kind of, you know, the perfect pillar of manhood, you know, come out that really bad behavior has been happening, it upsets me. And at the same time, there's then those talking about it, and the male voices are saying this is absolutely unacceptable. And for whatever reason, you know, I have a wife, I have daughters, and that don't engage in this kind of behavior, that find it appalling. And I'm concerned how many are out there, how many more that we won't even know about. And I do think that the backlash concern about a lack of mentoring and a lack of hiring and so forth is valid. I also hope that this is a watershed moment of those who are appalled, who are really going to back up and be more aware and back up their female colleagues even more than they ever have before, because now it's becoming so obvious that this is a problem, where I think a lot of people didn't realize it was really that big of a problem. And so those that are just kind of shocked and in awe of this, you know, horrible behavior of their colleagues, those males, I hope, will be more inclined to speak up or say something or do something, you know, that they maybe before would have been a little more silent. So it could be an extreme response in either direction. It'll be interesting to see.
I think there's another common bias that we haven't talked about yet, which is called the availability heuristic. And what that is the tendency to focus on information that's readily available and ignore things like base rates. So there's a lot of these stories coming out, but I think one of the points that Mandy got at very well is we don't need to make the assumption that there's no male allies in the workplace who think this is absolutely disgusting, right? The other thing is it doesn't take that much effort to address this issue and make people feel comfortable. So for me, I have two female graduate assistants this semester. So it was noisy in the hallway one time, and I was like, all right, I think we should close the door because it's noisy. And I asked her, are you comfortable with that? And she said, yes. And I said, okay. And then we just had our meeting for like whatever 15 minutes it was and then opened the door. It took me 2 seconds to do, but I think it's important to just understand that I'm in a power position here. She's my graduate assistant. You want to make sure that someone feels comfortable. So it's not really taking any of my time. And like, there's a lot of men in the workplace, I think, that I've talked to have heard this and they're like, wow, I cannot even believe that that happened. So,
yeah. It's interesting you say that, because as a woman, whenever someone says, should I shut the door? I say, because it's loud, but let's just crack it. You know, I don't like having my door shut, so it's good to ask.
And that would
be
fine. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think to Kyle's point, just to add here for a second, I think one of the backlashes that we should be thoughtful about and avoid is, at this moment, do women walk around and just wonder if every guy that they know is like a potential predator? And I think we need to be thoughtful about how we, again, support the male allies and recognize that there's just as much pain in this for men who don't want to be seen as the potential predator as all men, you know, or the assumption that we're putting all men into that potential predator category. And I think we have to be thoughtful about that as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, too, to note that the initial question was about sexual harassment, that men have come out as being sexually harassed as well. So they are sort of part of this conversation, too. So we're talking about an epidemic, really, about people violating personhood. And so I think... there was Tarana Burke, who created the Me Too hashtag that has been going around on social media. And there were so many people, I guess we would say just regular, everyday people, who were using the hashtag to communicate their stories. And to just go back to the importance of language and sort of framing, they were using this hashtag to communicate a story that, you know, sexual harassment is happening to many different people of all races, backgrounds, you know, you name it. And so how do we then, to sort of add to what has already been said by my colleagues, how do we sort of create structures that acknowledge that, you know, we need allies from every vantage point, and we also need to recognize that no person has been exempt from this as well. So how do we, again, begin to sort of change the culture of what's happening in these workplaces, from politics to academia to even to you know, working at fast food restaurants, even, right? So it's happening in lots of places. So how do we begin to address it? I think it's a hard question, a huge question, but a question nonetheless.
Yeah, I think the Me Too campaign was extremely eye-opening for me. Just seeing my friends, like on Facebook, that I knew and what happened to them. And I really appreciated the ones that were actually willing to tell their stories, even though I know it's hard to kind of send your very personal story out into the void and be like, I just want everyone to know about this. But that really, you know, painted a very clear picture of the kind of things that were going on, even with people close to you. And that can make a difference. I mean, there's a recent study came out that CEOs who have daughters have more equitable organizations for women as compared to CEOs who only have sons. And I think what that's saying is that when it gets close to you, people are much more willing. Because like we said in the previous segment, it's an unconscious bias. People aren't really aware of it. But once it becomes close to you, you take the effort to become aware of it. And then you're kind of like, I can address this. So yeah, that Me Too was eye-opening for me.
So Professor Smith, we wanted to ask you about the implicit bias training.
Yeah, in the last segment, we talked about all these subtle ways in which the way that we think about people impacts the way that we behave. And often we just don't even realize it. It's so embedded in the way that we've grown up and the images that we've seen in the world. And so one of the ways that we can combat some of the behaviors is to recognize how we think about them. So we may continue to have these implicit biases, but can we be aware of these biases and then change our behaviors? And can we start by recognizing that we all have these biases? And that's really tough to do because it's something that feels icky. We don't want to say, I'm biased. And yet, the more that we recognize our biases, the more that we can then change our behaviors. There is online, put up by Harvard's Project Implicit, a instrument in which you can spend about 5 minutes and recognize ways in which you might have biases in which, for example, you see women as leaders or men as leaders more often, or which you have associated black or white people with good or bad. And the recognition that these biases may exist can really help us to think about how we shift our behaviors.
Yeah, I think another way to view that is not necessarily as us being biased, as us being complex. You know, traditionally, we have a very mechanistic view of humans. They make logical decisions and take rational steps in order to decide how I'm going to address this person or whether I'm going to choose A or B. But in reality, humans are complex. We have all of these built-in mechanisms that allow us to quickly make decisions from very complex stimuli. So you're walking down an alley and you feel nervous, so you think you should get out of there. That's not a conscious decision. There's some evidence your body unconsciously processing your surroundings in order to give you this emotion, which is signaling we should get out. And there's just other ways that we do that, and one of those is by socially categorizing people. You don't have the time to go around and look at each individual person that you see every single day. You fit them into what you think their category should be based off, like we said, race, sex, age, also what they're wearing, also, you know, all these other things. So it's important to realize the way that you have these programs written for yourself, and the implicit associates test is a really good way to do that. And they have all kinds of different tests you can take. And like Wendy said, they only take a few minutes each, and it's kind of fun just to play, you know, with yourself and kind of see what happens.
So Jessica made an interesting point about the importance of diversity in the last interview that we did. She specifically was talking about how more diverse leadership roles in workplaces can help normalize what we see. And so those biases can be reduced because we don't only see people that look alike. We see people who are different from one another. And there's another benefit, lots of benefits to diversity, but there's a really interesting article that someone sent to me recently from The Economist about sex and brains, and the brain science is starting to do more and more and more research and analyzing the brain. And males and females' brains do have different patterns. And in this particular article that they posted, this study was showing that women are, you know, multitaskers more. Men tend to get more focused on one kind of thing. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. I've also myself done research on gender differences and a study on global mindset ability, looking at global leadership in men and women. And men and women are each equal on several of these different competencies. And then there is an equal number where there are significant gender differences. Women are more passionate about diversity. They're more interested in interpersonal relationships and so forth. And so these differences matter, because if you've got males only in leadership roles or predominantly in leadership roles, you're largely potentially missing a huge set of competencies that those that are different would have. And you can make the same argument for differences in race and differences in background and religious, because we just come to the table with different things and we don't all necessarily function the same way. And those competencies really very much matter.
I would add to what Mandy is saying, you know, we've jumped into this conversation about what are some of the problems in the workplace and how do we deal with them. And I would, you know, maybe go back to the question of, like, why should we care? And I think that there's a bunch of reasons to care, and it's actually valuable to recognize that there's, you know, we should care because it's important for people to bring their whole selves to work. We should care because it's the right thing to do. We should care because we want people to feel valued, you know, and I think those are probably the most important reasons to care. And we should also care because, and this is what Mandy was saying, that having a more diverse workplace is actually better for the outcomes of the workplace. It's better for the creativity in the workplace. It's better for, you know, if you want to be very instrumental, it's better for corporate performance. McKinsey has a wonderful study saying that diversity in the workplace adds to performance by 35%. So there's multiple reasons to care. And I think I say this because when Mandy and I started to talk about the Women's Leadership Initiative, we got a lot of pushback. And I think a bit of the pushback is that there's a real sense that if we're going to advance women, they have to be advanced to the detriment of men. In other words, it's this trade-off. It's this sense that somebody's going to get the position. Is it a woman or a man? And I raise this because I think maybe one of the things that we can do to be more effective when it comes to thinking about gender equity in the workplace is to change that assumption. So all of my research looks at the ways in which leaders think and notices whether leaders think in this kind of either-or format or whether we can kind of recognize that there is a both and, that there's an all boats rise, that there's a benefit more broadly. And so my sense is that when we talk about women in the workplace and we got this sort of defensive pushback, it was the sense of, well, if women are going to succeed, maybe I as the man won't. And the research at least bears out that if we help women succeed, if we help people succeed, if we're more inclusive, actually everybody does better. And maybe changing that mentality would be quite useful.
Yeah, that's a great point that Wendy makes. And I think part of it comes from, and some of us on the panel teach organizational behavior, so this is a question we probably get to in all our classes. What is a business organization, right? And no matter what the government says, it's not a person. An organization is not a person. It's a set of people that are trying to accomplish a common goal. So you don't need an organization in which you have people completely overlapping in their skill sets. What's the purpose of that? So building on what both Mandy and Wendy said, it's having a difference in backgrounds that allows the organization as a whole to have a greater resource set to draw from. And that's especially important when it comes to creativity and innovation in those sort of industries, as Wendy was saying. So if you think about just at a base level, what is the purpose of a business organization? You know, it makes sense that organizations that are naturally more diverse will perform better because they have a greater set of resources to draw from, given that they have a culture that allows that to happen, and given that they have strategies in place to be able to make use of it.
Mm-hmm. And I like what both Wendy and Kyle are saying about this, because I think not only is diversity in gender and race as well important for the workplace, but I think it's just important, and I've said this before, just for humankind. So we're talking about really trying to, we're only here for a moment, right? So we're trying to leave the world in a better space than we found it, I hope. And so actually creating these practices and showing our children, right? Because we're modeling what it means to be a leader. We're modeling what it means to be professional. How do we begin to create those practices so that they can see what it looks like, so that they can actually go on to create a new tomorrow?
You're listening to Campus Voices on 91.3 WVUD. Thank you, Professors Edwards, Smith, Ballou, and Emick, for coming in today and speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.